Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two guests today. First, imminently, we'll hear from the economist Heidi Shierholz on the miserable fate of young adults in today's job market. And at the bottom of the hour, Shama Sawant, the socialist on Seattle City Council, will talk to us about the campaign for a $15 an hour minimum wage, a core point in her election winning agenda, and the role of electoral politics in making serious social change. First up, Heidi Shierholz. She is a staff economist with the Economic Policy Institute, based in Washington. The other day, she wrote up the story of declining college enrollment over the last several years for the EPI website. She's the lead author of their annual report on what the job market holds for this year's high school and college graduates. The 2014 edition will be out soon. You can find the 2013 edition, which has lots of great historical detail, on EPI's website, epi.org. Heidi Shierholz. We're seeing a drop-off in the number of young folks going to college, right? What do the numbers look like?
Yeah, it's a worrisome trend. Since 2009, there's been a decline in the number of recent high school grads who are going to college. So, it got up over 70% or around 70% in 2009, and then it's gradually dropped back down in 2013. It was around 66%. It doesn't sound like a huge drop, but it's not a very long period, and it follows decades of increases. We've had increasing enrollment, increasing educational attainment for decades, and we're starting to see a reversal of that. So it's a really worrisome trend.
And it looked like the rate for women fell rather dramatically compared to men, although there are more women in college now, right?
Yes, the gender dynamics are very interesting on this. So the increases over time have been much greater for women. Women are, it's not a dramatic difference, but you can see a very noticeable difference that women are more likely to be enrolled in college now than men, but they've been hit particularly hard over the last few years. So while women are still more likely to be enrolled in college than men, they saw a bigger drop in the last few years. So now the gender differences are less in college enrollment than they used to be.
Now, there are a couple of theories about how this all relates to the economic cycle. One is that when times are bad, people go to college because they can't find jobs or they think they can get better jobs by going to college. On the other hand, when times are bad, they don't have the money to go to college. So what are the underlying causes, do you think?
I think both of those things are going on. There is literature. People have done really rigorous work to show, not just in the United States, but around the world, that when the labor market gets weak, that enrollment rates go up. The issue is they don't go up very much. You can sort of detect it in the data if you look really closely, but it is not offsetting the negative effects of the downturn. So what that means is in this downturn, we've seen a big increase in the number of young people who are, people call it, say, idle or disconnected. There's been a big increase in the number of young people who are not enrolled in school and not employed. This gets into the issue that a lot of students, in order to go to college, in good times and bad, actually have to work to put themselves through college. At a time like this, when job opportunities are so weak, you're going to have a lot of people who otherwise would have been able to go to college, but because they can't find a decent job, can no longer afford to attend. And then the other factor that we know is acting on this is that parents are much better able to help kids go to college when they have housing wealth. So when the housing bubble was inflated, people thought they were a lot wealthier than they were, and they were more able to take out a home equity loan to get their kid into college. Now that the housing bubble has burst, many parents are no longer able to do that. So you have students seeing their parents' wealth decline, so their parents can no longer help them out, students not being able to work because the labor market is weak, so these enrollment rates actually starting to drop now, which is a really worrisome trend, because what it means is that the scarring effects of the Great Recession, they're hidden and they're everywhere, that this is not something people think about as a first order issue, but if you have a lot fewer people enrolled in college due to these impacts of the Great Recession, it just means this cohort is going to be worse off for the rest of their lives.
And just a point, you mentioned the people who are detached, the younger people are detached in the sense that they're not working and not enrolled in college. That's more men than women, right?
Yes, that's right. When you look at the share of young people who are disconnected, idle, they're not enrolled in school and they are not employed, so they're sort of cut off from these two main avenues that they could take to set themselves up for their future careers. It's extremely elevated across the board, but it's hitting young men harder right now. There's more young men who are falling through the cracks, who are in this group of they're not working and they're also not in school.
And what do we know about the demographic composition of that population?
I don't have the breakdowns of the disconnected groups by race and ethnicity, but we can look at the breakdowns of unemployment by race and ethnicity and get a really pretty clear idea of what's going on. And that is that racial and ethnic minorities are getting hit harder by this downturn. You see their unemployment rates go up more. One thing that I think is important to note is that the unemployment rates of racial and ethnic minorities, even for young people who have the exact same amount of education, the unemployment rates for racial and ethnic minorities are higher in good times and in bad times. But at a time like this, when unemployment is really elevated, you see the unemployment rates of racial and ethnic minority young people extremely high.
And those rates are usually what, you know, any of these indicators of distress, whether we're talking about poverty or unemployment, they're usually like 1.5 to 2 times the white rate. Is that a good rule of thumb?
The ratio of unemployment between, say, black unemployment and white unemployment is generally about 2. So the unemployment rate for black workers is generally about twice as high as it is for white workers. And that ratio is pretty consistent in good times and bad. But what it means is when, you know, the overall unemployment rate goes up by 1 percentage point, the black unemployment rate goes up by 2 percentage points. So those racial and ethnic minority communities get hit really hard.
And then returning for a moment to the issue of affordability, college affordability, you mentioned the increasing difficulty of paying through home equity or employment or whatever, but there is also the price tag is going up rapidly too at the same time.
Right. So there's two sides of this. What does it take to be able to afford college? You need to have some kind of income, some kind of resources to pay for college. And so we know that's taken a big hit since the recession happened. But the other factor is how expensive college is. So college tuition has been increasing dramatically for a very long time, but it's gone up even more since the Great Recession hit, because you see, you know, states are pulling back. They've seen their funding drop, and so they've had to shift more of the cost onto students. Private universities saw their endowments drop, so they've increased tuition, not necessarily bringing it back down now that the stock market is back up. So college at public and private universities, the cost of college has gone up dramatically. So you have this situation where families are poorer than they were before the recession hit. College is more expensive, so you're having fewer people either able to go to college or coming out with, you have more people coming out with huge debt on the other side.
And we even have now the Federal Reserve Bank of New York worried about the macroeconomic effects of that debt burden, right?
Yeah, I think the concern about student loan debt, it's real. It's very real for the students who are holding that debt. We know that it will, there's good evidence that student debt is crowding out other investments that young people can make, investing in buying a house, mortgages, auto loans. So you have to pay these, you have to pay down your student debt every month. It means you can't do other things that may have helped set you up for your adult life. It's not a debt bubble that's going to bring down the economy. I've heard some people talk about how it's the next housing bubble. It's not. It's nowhere near as big as the housing bubble. It's not something that has the power to bring the economy to its knees, but it's definitely something that could mean, you know, these cohorts of young people who are sacked with this debt have to delay things that other generations got to take for granted.
And now let's move on to the labor market situation of younger adults. It's not too good, right?
No, it is not. It is still a very grim labor market out there for young people. It's getting better, so it's not as bad as it was. Everything sort of hit its worst point in three generations in 2010, and it's been slowly improving since then. But the problem is that word slowly. It has been improving so slowly that these groups still face very elevated unemployment, very weak job opportunities. And so many young people will face either unemployment or underemployment, that they, you know, they find a job but either can't get the hours they need, or say young college grads who are, you know, working as a barista. They have a job but they can't find one that actually uses their college degree. They'll get a job more than the high school grad who sort of falls off the bottom of the occupational ladder, but that might be a job that's much, much lower than what they, you know, were expecting when they made the huge investment of time and money in their college degree. All of this puts huge downward pressure on the wages of young people. It's actually, there's weak wage growth across the board, but you can really see it for young people. Wages have dropped a lot since the Great Recession hit, and the logic there is really straightforward. Economists can write this in formulas, but it's completely intuitive. Employers don't have to pay big wage increases to get and keep the workers that they need. And so you see these wages dropping because workers don't have outside options in a labor market like this. So we see many of this young cohort are going to suffer from unemployment, periods of underemployment, and for those who are lucky enough to find a job, they're going to see lower wage growth than they otherwise would have if they hadn't had the misfortune to be born at a time that dropped them as young new entrants to the labor market into a labor market as weak as the one we're in now.
I'm speaking with Heidi Scherholz, who is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. Yeah, there are some studies of what it's like for people who graduate into recessions, and I was actually one of those people back in 1975. What do we know about graduating into recession? It's not good for your long-term prospects, is it?
Yeah, it's really amazing how long-lasting the effects are. So the best studies show that people who, I think a way I like to think of this is, in any graduating class, you're going to have some people who do great, some people who do mediocre, and some people who really struggle. When you're in a weak labor market, those shares change. So many more people do really struggle. Many fewer people do really great. So as a cohort, as a group, people who graduate into a labor market like this won't do well on average. And the effects of that last for a long time. The best studies show that the impact of graduating into a weak labor market means you're going to have much lower earnings, and you're going to have lower earnings for a long time, for 10 to 15 years, until you can sort of get back on the happy trajectory you would have been on if you'd been able to graduate into a strong economy. But even if you get back on that trajectory, you're never getting that money back. If you have reduced earnings for 10 to 15 years, that could be a down payment on a house that you just don't have because you were unlucky and you got started on this lower trajectory. So what we'll see is, even after the larger economy recovers, this group will continue to be set back for a long time because those first jobs you get out of school are really important to setting you up for your career.
And the studies you're talking about are based on earlier recessions, which, well, no picnic, were also nowhere near as severe as what we went through recently, right?
That is a very good point. So, right, just to reiterate what you said, the best information that we have on the lasting effects of entering a recession or entering a labor market during a downturn was done on people who entered during the early 80s downturn, and that was severe, but it was nothing like the one we just experienced. The Great Recession and its aftermath were dramatically more severe and have lasted. The weakness has lasted much, much longer than the admittedly very long and severe recession of the early 80s. So we are in the situation where economists would call it, we're out of sample. We're trying to figure out what will happen in a situation where we haven't seen anything like this before. And so what that suggests is that these cohorts who are entering the labor market during the Great Recession and its aftermath will likely be, if anything, worse off, that the negative effects of entering during the downturn will be more severe and last longer. So we're in the situation where those, you know, having reduced earnings for 10 to 15 years might actually be optimistic for this group.
Yeah, that early 80s recession you were talking about, it was deep and nasty, but there was a fairly rapid bounce back, which is not the case this time.
Exactly. We got that nice V after the early 80s recession, and here we're just in this slog, and you know, we're going to be in a slog for, I would say, at least 2-3 more years. So the recovery has looked nothing like the recovery of the early 80s. That it is weird to say, but the people who entered the labor market during the recession of the early 80s are really lucky compared to the people who entered the labor market in the aftermath of the Great Recession.
And then there is a trendy meme circulating that there's really no point in going to college. And Peter Thiel, of course, the Silicon Valley entrepreneur, is promoting this very heavily with his reputation as money. But you hear this from time to time. There's just no point in going to college these days. Is that really true?
No, it's not. I mean, you will definitely find some people who, you know, would have been better off without going to college. But on average, wages of people with a college degree are much higher than those of people without a college degree. The calculus still works out that for most people, you're going to do better if you have a college degree compared to if you don't. The calculus is a little less clear than it used to be. Now college costs a lot more. The benefits to having a college degree used to be increasing, that you saw the differential in wages between those with and without a college degree growing. Not anymore. It's been really flat since the 90s. In other words, people with a college degree aren't seeing their advantage grow as they used to. College wages have been flat for the last decade, no increases. I mean, when I say college wages, I mean the wages of people with a college degree. So the calculus on sort of the cost-benefit analysis of going to college, is it worth it? Will it pay off? It's still really clear, on average, you're going to do better if you have a college degree, but it's getting less clear than it used to be.
And what can we say about like the wages of younger people, comparing like, college grads and people with only high school? What has the trajectory been of their wage patterns over the last, say, 20 years?
That's a very interesting period. So we'll start with the good stuff. In the period of the late 90s, wages of young people did great. Both college wages, high school wages, men, women, everyone saw their wages grow in that period of very strong labor markets. You know, the unemployment rate got just drop, got down to 4% in 2000. In an environment like that, you know, employers had to pay wage increases to get and keep the workers they needed. And so people really saw strong wage growth. Since then, hasn't been so great. In the business cycle from 2000 to 2007, that's the sort of last full business cycle before the Great Recession hit, wage growth was really flat. No group that college, young college grads, young high school grads, everyone saw, like, either remained flat or actually saw losses over the period from 2000 to 2007. So nothing good happened in that business cycle. And then the Great Recession hit, and everyone's wages took a real drop. So if you look over the entire period since 2000, the wages of young high school grads, the wages of young college grads have taken a severe hit. So it has not been a good century for the wages of young workers. It also hasn't been a good century for the wages of workers overall, but you really see a stark change after the strong labor market of the 90s. To me, that really underscores how it matters what kind of labor market you enter into. If you entered into the labor market of the late 90s, you were really set up well. Since then, it's been a lot worse.
And it's not just wages, the benefits. I was surprised looking at your paper from last year, the class of 2013. You'll be shortly coming out with the 2014 prospects for graduates. But the drop in benefits, especially jobs with healthcare benefits over the last 10, 15 years, has been stunning.
Yeah, I think looking at benefits really underscores something about job quality, how much employers are investing in their young workers. So if you look at health insurance benefits, they have just plummeted the share of young workers who are working in jobs that where they get employer-provided health insurance. It has really dropped since 2000. Pension plans. Many young people aren't thinking about their pensions, but it is a real signal of job quality. Very few, the share of workers, young workers, both college grads and high school grads who are in jobs where they get some form of a pension plan from their company has really dropped since 2000. So these measures that we think of as being the compensation package, or the whole deal, what kind of job quality are people really getting, it looks bad across the board. It's not like, oh, wages are suffering, but there's been a big increase in pensions, or wages are suffering, but they're getting a lot more health care. We're not seeing that. It really is, however you cut it, we're seeing a real erosion of job quality.
And then finally, I'd just be interested in doing some generalizations about kids today. You know, are there prospects, are there material standards of living now relative to the average and relative to earlier cohorts? Are they better off, worse off? Is this particular generation really getting an unusually raw deal than compared to its predecessors?
Yep, I think that's right. The impact of on the millennials of entering the downturn during the Great Recession is going to be severe. But this stagnation of, you know, people maybe not seeing growth in living standards compared to their parents, that started long before this generation. It was the baby boomers were the last generation that saw, you know, as a group, rising living standards compared to their parents. You know, it used to be that, you know, each generation successively were sort of better and better and better off. Since the baby boomers, the vast majority have not seen higher incomes than their parents. This group, they're poised to actually see big declines because of the impact of the bad start they're getting from entering the labor market during a downturn.
And this prompts some people to go with this sort of generational war interpretation of things, but it seems to me there are younger people, just each successive wave of younger people are inheriting a progressively more deteriorated economy.
Yeah, I do feel like, I haven't really seen it yet, but I keep waiting for these millennials to get labeled as lazy or unproductive or not that smart or not that flexible or whatever it is, however we're going to start talking about them, because as a group, they're not going to do well. We know that they are facing this big setback just through bad luck of when they were born to enter the labor market during this downturn. So I think part of it has to do with the fact that because the unemployment rate of college grads is still so high, we haven't started calling them bad names yet, but I have a feeling that it won't be long before you start seeing this group labeled as it's somehow their fault. And I think it's important, in my view, that we keep in mind that they got a really, really unfair start.
That was Heidi Scherholz of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. Like I said in the interview, I don't like the generational war approach to politics. There's something fundamentally reactionary about it, pitting young against old, education spending against Social Security. It's the politics of rivalry and scarcity in an economy that can afford all these things. The way I see it, the problems of today's young adults, and of each cohort since my boomer crowd, is that they're successively coming of age in a rotting economy. Yes, there's an us-against-them aspect to this, but it shouldn't be young against old, it should be the rich versus everyone else. Saying we can't afford both free college education and a civilized public pension system is ludicrous in a $17 trillion economy. The real problem is the top 1% are getting 90% of the income growth in this so-called recovery. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwin, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
You're dead and buried, us out of bone. You clean up the ashes and we light the fire. They're queuing up to dance on socialism's grave. What you call a sane man is now an impotent man.
That was Summer Funeral by the Mekons. They're queuing up to dance on socialism's grave. This funeral is for the wrong corpse. Next up is Shauna Sawant, and apologies for my unsubtle pronunciation of the double consonant at the beginning of her first name. Sawant ran as an independent socialist candidate for the Seattle City Council on a simple platform, a $15 an hour minimum wage, taxing the rich, funding schools, controlling rents. Yet she made no secret of her more radical long-term agenda. Personally, I'd like to see 2-3 mini Sawants across the USA, so it's worth listening to her thoughts on making seriously transformative politics practical. Apologies for the audio quality on this. You'd think the Seattle government would have a better phone line. Guess that's austerity for you. Shauna Sawant.
Before we talk about your campaign for 15, just what's it like being in the city council? Has it changed your view of how Seattle works at all?
It's quite amazing to be in office as an avowed socialist and as a fighter for the working class, because it gives us an opportunity to demonstrate, not just in theory but in actuality, that the conventional wisdom that activism and being a legislator or a public servant do not mix. It's always been a false dichotomy, because the question is, what do you want to use your seat for? I think people are starting to see that we indeed need independent working class candidates to run and win elections, because we need our own voices in not only in City Hall but in state and the federal government. And not only are we not suppressing movements, in fact, having a city council seat helps me to amplify my voice as an activist and to really lend that microphone to help movements grow and help inspire people into action.
What's your relationship with your colleagues like? Do you feel like you've been able to make some alliances or change the political discourse?
I think just the fact that a socialist, and not only just a socialist, but a grassroots candidate got elected, not taking a penny from big corporations and not taking home the full six-figure salary. You know, city council pays $120,000 to each council member. I'm taking home only $40,000 and donating the rest to build social justice movements. And having the $15 measure passed in SeaTac through the labor movement and grassroots activism through fast food workers moving into action. And then looking even farther back through the Occupy movement, ending the silence on economic justice and social inequality. All of this has had a tremendous impact on politics and business as usual, and it forces
establishment politicians to pay attention to these things. And from a personal standpoint, I have cordial relations with the council members, but that does not stop me from doing the work I need to do as a genuine representative of the working class. And if you are going to genuinely represent the working class, then you are going to rock the boat. You are going to ruffle some feathers. There is no way of doing it otherwise. I mean, seriously, if addressing income inequality and establishing a just society was merely a matter of sitting with the billionaires and the establishment politicians for coffee and talking nicely with them, then that would have happened. But in reality, there is a built-in class conflict in these struggles. The reason we are struggling is because the capitalist system overwhelmingly favors the richest of the rich, and you see policy making and government within capitalism also, you know, functioning in that way. It functions, the government is a tool for that. And so when you start challenging that, you're going to ruffle some feathers, and you have to be okay with that. In fact, I would say that if I wasn't ruffling feathers, I would wonder if I was doing something wrong.
And you talk like this in public about capitalism and class conflict. I admire that a great deal. So now let's talk about the fight for 15. What's the environment like in Seattle around the $15 an hour minimum?
I would say that, first of all, the main highlight, the main lesson that we should all draw from events as they have been unfolding in Seattle and in SeaTac last year is that grassroots movements work. You know, it was the fast food workers in New York City that walked out with the demand of 15 and a union, the SeaTac initiative for $15 an hour, our grassroots campaign for $15 an hour, rent control and taxing the rich, all of that, it shows how much you can change politics in a very, very short period of time. And if you look at what the political landscape was like at the beginning of last year, none of the corporate politicians, none of the corp media were talking about 15. If anything, they were poo-pooing it. And not only has that changed, everybody is forced to look at it seriously, but the mayoral candidate, you know, Ed Murray, who became the mayor when I was elected about a month or less than a month before the election day last year, he came out in support of $15 an hour. And he formed this committee, what he calls the Income Inequality Advisory Committee. I am on that committee. Just the fact that $15 an hour is at the top of the political agenda of this city is a demonstration that movements work, you know, grassroots pressures work. But I would say that the battle now has shifted to big business and businesses that are antagonistic to the demand for $15 an hour that really have no problem having their workers working year after year on poverty wages, are not in a position to come out and say that they are against 15 because of the tremendous public support that $15 an hour has. You know, a poll recently showed that 70% of Seattle's likely voters prefer a strong $15 measure. Businesses are now moving into the next front where they're trying to make sure that if something passes to the council, it will be a severely watered-down version, which I call a Swiss cheese 15, which will be 15 in name but not in substance, with all kinds of carve-outs. Allowing that to happen would be like one step forward, two steps back.
Several times you mentioned the fight in SeaTac. A lot of people outside Seattle might not know what that's about, so could you review that?
Yes, definitely. SeaTac is a small city next to Seattle. You know, the main source of economic sustenance there is the airport, you know, the SeaTac International Airport, Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. So the labor movement and low-wage workers in SeaTac ran a ballot initiative last year for a $15 an hour measure, and that passed even though businesses poured in several hundreds of thousands of dollars against it. You know, they ran massive advertising campaigns. I ran into a lot of people who were really confused about the whole thing because of all the vilification that they had seen from business, saying that this would just be the death knell of seat tax economy. And if you look at a lot of the workers who work at, say, the Starbucks at the airport or the different concession stands, you know, different workers, baggage handlers and so on, all of these people who make the airport run every single day have been at poverty wages for a long time, and also many of them are immigrants and people of color. So big business that fought against this was not even averse to using racism, you know, sort of it's racist innuendo to vilify the demand, because the face of the workers fighting for $15 an hour was, you know, East African, you know, immigrants. And so that was also used. But it shows, the fact that CTAC succeeded shows that ordinary people, working class people, have an instinct to stand together. And even when they're subjected to this kind of good old divide and rule strategies, divide and conquer strategies, they can fight that and rise above that. And CTAC showed that. And I think we should use that as an inspiring example for Seattle and the rest of the country.
And your strategy for Seattle, can the city raise a minimum wage on its own, or does it need state approval?
Per state law, the municipality can raise its minimum wage. But I think it's a good question you asked, Doug, because if you see in Oklahoma, you know, the Oklahoma governor saying that basically the Oklahoma state legislature, the moment they saw some movement towards minimum wage increase in Oklahoma City, went ahead and said, well, you know, we're going to just outlaw this. It's a very common tactic used by especially Republicans, but even Democrats, and basically by establishment politicians. So the point is that the legal system and the electoral system, it's not the most beneficial terrain for making social change. You know, while we should use every avenue possible for us, you know, just like we ran an election and won, and, you know, we are occupying an office at City Hall, we should use every legalistic and electoral means possible that we can to further the interests of the working class. We should remember that they are not substitutes for building mass movements. And ultimately, that is what we have to do to challenge legal obstacles as well. So I would say that, you know, I would give an example of rent control. You know, we also ran on the demand for rent control in Washington State. Rent control is outlawed. No municipality can carry out a rent control measure. And that happened just like in Oklahoma on the minimum wage issue. That happened in the 1980s in response to some folks in Seattle pushing for rent control. So I would say that we will run into obstacles. And even if it's illegal, I think we should look at forming mass movements that can fight against that.
And you also ran a platform around schooling. Has Seattle been subject to the usual bourgeois education reform testing and all that business?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, the teachers of the Seattle Education Association, you know, who are the teachers of the Seattle public schools, the grade schools, have been quite outspoken and courageous in fighting against standardized testing. And they've had several rallies and campaigns around it. And in fact, it was sort of happening parallel to our campaign for city council last year. And I and Socialist Alternative, we were both very supportive of those struggles. And I was at several of those rallies, both in my capacity as a community college teacher and a teachers union member, and also as a candidate for city council. You know, and I think that these bourgeois education reforms, the so-called reforms, are happening everywhere. And Seattle is no exception. And in fact, I was recently in Chicago for the Labor Notes conference, and, you know, obviously there was a lot of conversation about what's happening with schools in Chicago, the CTU's struggle, and Rahm Emanuel. And obviously, you know, that was not a crowd where I needed to convince that Rahm Emanuel, you know, his agenda has been quite destructive to education in Chicago, especially to poor and black neighborhoods. But what needs to be said, how are we going to challenge this agenda of destroying public education, of destroying investments in these resources that the labor movement and movements, social movements fought for, you know, generations ago? The reason we had that was because people made sacrifices then to fight against the system, to fight against the ruling class and get funding for education, to set up community colleges, to set up public schools and so on. And now all of that is being dismantled. But it's not just Republicans who are doing it, it's the Democrats too. In fact, the most effective attacks against and systematic attacks against public education have happened under Obama's Department of Education. So it's not enough for us, for people in the left, to just say, you know, gather over dinner and complain about it or boo Rahm Emanuel. It's important to pose a real challenge. And so the, you know, the question really is the Chicago Teachers Union going to run a slate of independent candidates for aldermen, you know, for the city council that will openly challenge the Democratic Party?
I'm speaking with Shama Swant, who is a city council person in Seattle, who ran as an independent socialist and won. Picking up on something you said earlier, it seems that it's quite possible that having someone like you in office at the same time you have social movements, both these things could encourage each other. I mean, they're not really rivals for attention. It's not electoral politics versus street politics, but the two can feed each other in productive ways. Is that correct?
I think that they definitely can. The question that people should focus on is who should be the candidates, what kind of campaign platform do we want, and also who runs these candidates. I mean, you know, if somebody was well-intentioned, well-meaning, but running on their own, then it's easy to imagine what would happen if they did get elected. It's much simpler. I mean, this is the way capitalism or any class system, you know, which relies on exploitation works. The best strategy is if you can co-opt that person into your agenda. That's the most useful way to do it because it doesn't even look like there's any conflict. So I would say that it's not only important that we recognize that there isn't necessarily a conflict between running candidates and developing movements, but it's a question of who the candidates are, what is the program that they're running on, and who are they accountable to. You know, when we ran the campaign was not initiated because I woke up one morning and decided I wanted a political career and I wanted to be well-known or anything like that. The main question that we first debated in Socialist Alternative in our national organization was, does it make sense to run an electoral campaign this year? And if yes, then who might be the most effective representative of politics? Then another source of debate, obviously, is what should the campaign platform be? What should be the highlights? How should we run? Should we take money from big corporations or not? Should we have a candidate who is willing to live on an average worker's wage and give the rest to social movements? Is that person going to be accountable? How do we hold them accountable? You know, all of these questions have to come to the fore because it is not merely a question of building a party independent of the Democrats and Republicans. It's an important question of what kind of party it is. People in the U.S. always say, well, we need a third party. And of course they're, but you know, I come from India where there are many so-called third parties, none of whom are serving the interests of the working class, and all of whom, virtually all of whom, have colluded with the deeply destructive neoliberal agenda in the last 30 to 50 years. And so it's not just a question of a third party. It's a question of what that party looks like, who is going to formulate the principles, you know, what are the core principles of that party, who gets to run it, who gets vote, you know, those sorts of questions are important.
And from your experience, what advice would you give people in other cities that might be contemplating a similar campaign? And for one, I noticed you had a pretty simple agenda. It was just like 3 or 4 points. You didn't talk about expropriating the expropriators. You just had some very practical things that speak to people's daily lives. Is that an important approach?
I think it's very important to make sure that the politics of the campaign speak to the people who are going to be, you know, who support you want to garner. And for us, when we say support, it doesn't mean just votes in a crass careerist manner. I mean, we are not careerist. In fact, that has to be a absolutely important criterion. In fact, when I tell people that I didn't really want to play this role, I've been an activist with Socialist Alternative for the last 5 years. 2 years ago when I was proposed as a candidate, for me it was, for personally, it was sort of earth-shattering. I was like, no, there's no way I want to do that. And I heard a lot of people saying, well, that's precisely why you should be doing it, because we are not going to be able to build a genuine movement, international movement, to liberate the working class unless we have people who are truly driven by their desire to fight for social justice and not for careerist reasons. And so that has to be part of the focus. But the other part is, of course, exactly what you said, which is having a political program that connects with what people are thinking about, how their daily lives are conducted and what are they affected by, but not staying limited to that and raising their sights to even more. So, you know, it's what we would call a transitional approach, meaning the demands on your program have to be something that people feel they can win, but shouldn't be so moderate that they don't feel like they need to be involved. So, you know, it's that balance between something that inspires people into action and yet something that seems winnable. And $15 an hour was one of those points. Taxing the rich was one of those points. And rent control, you know, we were very honest. You know, we will need a mass movement around that. But we were willing to use that as part of the program to be able to challenge, you know, why is cost of housing so high in Seattle? It's because all of the land and the buildings and everything have been given over to big developers like Paul Allen, and this is no longer our city. It no longer belongs to us. And so, you know, it helps to challenge that. So you have to have a program that is both simple and reaches people into things that they identify in their daily lives. But again, at the same time, that doesn't stop us from bringing up, you know, raising people's sights to an alternate society, an alternate economy, and saying that this is the reason we need to do it. You know, when people ask me, well, wouldn't $15 an hour just end up, you know, wouldn't the real value of the dollar end up being eroded over several decades again? And my response is, that is probably true, and that is why we can't stop at winning $15 an hour. We cannot end the misery of the working class just by winning 15. However, we need to do that. We need to fight for strong reforms like $15 an hour, because that's a way of both substantially improving people's standards of living and drawing them into a movement for larger things.
And finally, I mean, 15 sounds reasonable. It's hard to live on less. But it also is about the 40th percentile of the national wage distribution. So it is a serious demand. It's asking a lot, in other words. It would really be system challenging. So how do you deal with that fact? I mean, you're really asking for a lot by asking for 15.
That's absolutely, it's a very astute way of putting it. I like how you said that. I think that it's a double-edged sword, meaning that because it really does pose a challenge to the capitalist way of functioning. It really, you know, because it would be such a substantial increase in wages for over 100,000 workers in Seattle, and the fact that it will inspire similar struggles elsewhere, it does, you know, evoke a certain sharp response from big business, and in that sense, the hurdles are pretty significant, because it is an all-out class battle. I mean, this is what Seattle is going through right now. I mean, you know, the vocabulary of class and class conflict has been eroded over decades of, you know, papering over it and, you know, talking about how we are all Americans, the American dream and all of that. And the heyday of the labor movement is so far behind us, you know, that generations haven't experienced it. But what is going on in Seattle is exactly that. It's a class battle that is going on, because the demand is so significant that it has implied, and we knew it would imply, that big business will come all out and fight against it, not only because of what it means in Seattle, but what implications it has as a domino effect for the rest of the nation. But the other edge of the sword is that both because of the sharpness of business response and because of the promise of a substantial increase, improvement in standards of living, it has the power to inspire large numbers of people into action, because it makes them feel like, you know what, this is worth fighting for. This is worth putting my personal life aside for a while and putting my energies into this. Because, you know, ultimately that is what we need. You know, we talk about movements and mass movements and mass action, nonviolent civil disobedience actions. We talk about all of these things, but what are these things ultimately? How do these things come? How do these events come about? They come about only when large numbers of people feel invested in it and are going to dedicate a big chunk of their time, a big chunk of their life to it. And I think the $15 an hour demand has shown that it has that power to galvanize action from large numbers of people from the working class.
And if a system can't pay $15 an hour, it's a busted and sick system, right?
Exactly. It's been a good tool for us to highlight that, you know, because people understand from their from just their daily life that even 15 is not enough. Because, you know, let's make sure everybody knows the math. At full time work, $15 an hour only means $30,000 a year. I don't think anybody can honestly claim that that's some sort of outlandish lifestyle. $30,000 is the minimum. So when people say they think, oh, that's a reasonable thing. I should get 15 because of all the work. Look at all the work I'm doing. I should at least get 15. And when they see the how sharp the business response is against it, it really triggers them into life because they feel outraged. They feel that, how dare you say that I'm asking for too much? Look at the average CEO salary. It's $7,000 an hour. And you say that I have, I have too much nerve to ask for 15. And it really gives us the opportunity to say exactly what you said, Doug, which is that if the system requires workers to remain at poverty wages in order to sustain itself, then that system is indefensible.
I was Shama Sawant, the socialist member of the Seattle City Council. As you may have heard, we had a punishing winter on the East Coast, which is finally over. So let's go out with this, the beginning of Beethoven's Spring Sonata for violin and piano, performed by Itzhak Perlman and Vladimir Ashkenazy. Till next week, bye. Thank you.